To begin again, I'm Clint Morrison. This is section four, session four of our series on Japan and Japanese culture and what it means to us and how it affects us. The conventional wisdom in the U.S. is that a speaker always starts out with a joke. In Japan, you start out with an apology, so let me apologize for taking the next hour or so of your time. This is the way I have of reuniting myself with as a member of the group, even though you're sitting there listening and I'm here talking. So rather than tell you the one about the American and the Japanese and the German and the French businessmen, I'll let go and I'll start off with an apology. I taught a course at Oregon State for a couple of years with upper-level Japanese students who I was interested in getting enhancing their proficiency to read technical and scientific and basically non-fiction descriptive literature. And I didn't get enough students involved until I called the course, instead of Japanese for Science and Technology, I called it Japanese for Business, Science and Technology, and all of a sudden the enrollment doubled and we had enough people to fill out the course. I was interested in seeing whether putting business in the title of this session would increase the number of people who came, and I'm sorry to report that so far it doesn't seem to have done that. Well, I hope that the good weather is keeping a few people outside for a little longer than they normally would be, and we'll see some more people walking in. Let me start out with some input from you on what kind of words and concepts come to your mind when we talk about business in Japan or business in Japanese culture or Japanese manufacturing or any of these things that have been real hot topics in our society for many years.
Production lines.
Okay, production lines. Okay.
Concentration
of resources or?
Of thought.
Thought, okay. Mental concentration.
Efficiency.
Efficiency. Yeah?
Perfection.
Perfection. Okay. Drive for perfection.
Quality circle.
Quality. Big word. Quality circles, quality control.
Right.
Right. Good old American concept. Sorry?
A long-term horizon.
Long-term. Right. Long-term horizon. Okay.
Just in time.
Just in time.
Right.
Just in time. That expression says a lot. Anything else? This gives us a lot to begin with.
Deming ideology.
Deming, right. Good old Japanese name, Deming. A lot of this began right here.
The concern of the employees, you know, on the work surrounding.
Right. Concern for employees.
Yeah.
Right. Concern for employees. I'm going to need this blackboard space several times over, so I may wind up erasing these, but most of these, in fact, all of them, I will get back to within the hour.
How about lifetime employment?
Lifetime employment. Okay. Lifetime employment, if in fact there is such a thing. I suppose if you die on the production line, you were employed for your lifetime.
Politeness.
Politeness. Okay. Feature of Japanese society, on the outside at least, and often on the inside as well.
A commitment to the company.
Okay. Commitment. Right.
Discipline.
This one's been up here every day this week. Discipline. Yeah. Okay, I'm starting to get a good nucleus of thought here. I would like, as we go along, to consider the strengths and weaknesses of both sides here. There was a time in the 50s and 60s when people ignored Japanese business and Japanese manufacturing and Japan altogether. Suddenly in the 70s, when the Japanese economic miracle sort of swelled to a full crescendo, then the first reaction on this side was, oh my gosh, they're all 10 feet tall, we can't possibly compete with this marvelous industrial society. Then thankfully that seems to have crashed a little bit later, after the first series of books that came out, that Japan is number one, Japan in the passing lane, and so on. Then a lot of the concepts that seem to be working in Japan were tried in American companies initially. The quality circle experiment failed brilliantly in some companies, and there was a kind of a bashing that went on that said none of this will work over here. Gradually, we seem to be approximating an understanding of what will work in the U.S. and what won't work, and why Japanese do the things they do, and why we do some of the things that that we do well, in some cases even better. So I'm not here to bash the United States of America, nor am I here to bash Japan. There's plenty of opportunity to do both of those things as we go along. Let me move to page two, as Paul Harvey would say, and I'm going to take some of these things and sort of put them down the left side, and then make a column, head one column J and head one column US here, and see what we can put on either side of the coin. Let me start with one. I'm calling it hiring. It basically is employees. What kind of employees do you look for? How do you treat them? What do you expect them to have when they arrive? Let's put J here and US there, because it depends on that side of the Pacific when you look at the map. I'd say in one word, Japanese companies and employers want to hire people. That is, look for the best people they can find. And I would contrast this with, anybody over here? Skills, okay? U.S. employers are going to look for skills. Get me a welder. Get me an accountant. Get me somebody with an MBA from a big school. Assuming that that implies certain skills. A Japanese company might say, get me somebody from a good school, get me somebody from Tokyo University, Waseda, because I assume that means they're going to be a certain level of person. My next quality control engineer might come out of the political science and economics program at Keio University, but because he went to Keio, I'll assume that he had the family background and the staying power and the resources and the brains to get into Keio in the first place, and that he knows lots of people from Keio too, and there are lots of other people from Keio in the banks that I deal with and in my company. Therefore, he'll be plugged into a sort of a network. I can teach him anything I need to teach him once he joins the company. The company has teaching skills. I'm just looking for somebody from the right school with the right connections with the right personality. Okay. Over here, we're looking for specific skills, and our education system complains, or our business complains, that the schools aren't turning out people with the skills we need. How about an office layout? You look at it, has anyone ever seen a Japanese office?
One room.
One room, yeah, one big open floor with anywhere from 30 to 180 desks out there in rows and columns with heads at the end of the desk. Open U.S. office?
Cubicles.
Cubicles, right? Cubicles, and if you're a little bit above cubicle level, you have a door you can close, right? An office with a door and a nameplate on it. And when the door is closed, only people who are allowed to knock on that door probably will knock on it and be admitted.
Is Japan, you know, their employment area, is it kind of simplicity like their homes? You know, there's not a lot of, isn't there a lot of simplicity in their homes?
There's simplicity in architecture and design in Japanese homes. A lot of Japanese apartments and small homes are so small that there's literally no place to put things except out in the open.
And is there a place of employment like that too?
I'd say it's not very elaborate. There may be plants in the corner, one or two, and a tea machine, but not elaborate as far as major graphic designs on the walls and music in the corridors.
Actually, most of them are rather dreary.
Yeah.
Their homes too is like living in a closet.
The government offices in particular are like living in a cluttered closet. I mean, cardboard boxes of papers stacked to the ceiling on top of file cabinets, and there's no attempt to put up partitions and make the place look any slicker than it really is, and it isn't. Use of time. We discussed this a little bit yesterday in the contrasting roles of men and women. U.S., when I'm off work, I'm off. When I'm out of this place, my time's my own. 5 o'clock world, all that business. So there's a dual concept of company and private time. Here, for men on the track up, especially for those who aspire to be anything more than they are at the moment, company time. There are Japanese who go home early every day, or go home right on time. And there are seems to me to be quite a distinction made from inside the office. If you're one of the people who's continually opting out to go home and take care of your home and your family, that's understood. But you are now becoming one of the employees who is sort of in the others category. That is, you're visibly not giving all of your attention to advancement within the company. And you're kind of removing yourself from the inner circle or the core for promotion. Goals. Stated goals of the company. What's a company supposed to do in this country?
Make money.
Make money, right? It's a profit-making instrument. A couple of bad quarters or a couple of quarters in the red, and what happens to the stock price, right? Down it goes. And maybe down it stays, or maybe it gets taken over by Carl Icahn or somebody. And all kinds of things happen to it. If you look at the stated goals of a Japanese company, and in fact the way they behave, the first goal is almost always to be a productive member of society. Right? Stability, to provide stable occupation for employees. No ups, no downs, no surprises. To use the skills of the employee, to produce a product of value, to provide career employment for employees so that they are not suddenly thrown out on the street. These are the highest, they're usually the number 1 through 6 or 7 or 8 of the stated goals of any company are going to be like this. Then down there somewhere comes to provide a profit or a return on the investment of our investors, way down there. And it's generally not considered a vice, if you're a Japanese company, to operate fairly close to the break-even point. If you make less money, you pay less taxes. And every stockholder can agree that you don't want to pay any more taxes to the government than you have to. If you don't make as much money as someone in the U.S., well, you're probably investing more of your money in new plant and equipment, too. So the investors don't necessarily demand profit, profit, profit in Japan, as long as the company can show that it's investing in new facilities for the future. I can go on here. Relations with other companies, long-standing, and any number of negotiations where the Japanese company says, we want a partner in the U.S. that we can do business with for 5, 10, 20, 50 years. We want to know that you're going to be here, and we want to see similar commitment on your part. But once you're our partner, you're going to stay our partner. Don't worry about it. Over here, it's mutual advantage, right? For as long as that lasts, and it may not last very long. If you're giving me a better deal on widgets this week, I'll continue buying widgets from you for 3 months, 6 months, until I get a better deal over here. And then I'm sorry, your price is no longer competitive, and over we go. Right? When this price is no longer any good, if I want to get back to you and buy widgets from you, you can cut me off and say you're already selling to Boeing, you don't have any more capacity, and that's my tough luck. We don't have any particular agreement that we're going to work on this for an extended period of time. There are other similar contrasts I could make. The status of manufacturing technology, manufacturing engineers are some of the most valued people in any Japanese manufacturing organization. The status of anyone who's a specialist in manufacturing in the U.S. company, particularly in the business school circuit, has been very low, far below finance and accounting. Finance and accounting specialists go to banks and make lots of money. Manufacturing has basically been for those who can't do anything else. Until very recently, if you talked about teaching even one course on manufacturing in an American business school, you were laughed at. Literally. So there's a difference in priorities that's been remarked about now for 10 or 15 years. It's changing in the U.S. as we see that Japanese businesses have some strengths that we'd do very well to emulate, to copy. And I believe it's quite clear that this line down here has become a watershed for U.S. industries. Some U.S. companies, such as Ford for sure, and probably not General Motors, some have been able to follow the lessons that Japanese manufacturing has taught us. And those companies are going forward and competing in the same world. The companies that have not been able to follow those lessons are increasingly competing in an old-style U.S. world and are having a much harder time coping with the challenges that the Japanese have been able to throw at us, throw at the U.S. one after the other. What are some of the industries in the U.S. that used to exist which are now virtually dominated by Japanese products?
Steel.
It's interesting that that would be the first one. We usually think of consumer electronics right away, but steel is a major one. Fortunately, it's very expensive to ship steel a long way, so that if you can make steel in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, even slightly more expensive than they can make it in Japan, you will probably still have a market because it costs so much to ship that steel from Osaka. But that's an excellent comment. Any others?
Shipbuilding.
Shipbuilding, right. The shipbuilding industry in this country is
pretty well gone. Taking it over.
Korea is taking that over from Japan by doing exactly what Japan did earlier. Korea now has bigger, more modern shipyards and lower costs. Others?
Some lumber and beef.
Some lumber and beef.
Yeah. Japanese, for example, are processing lumber in ships off the Washington coast here.
Hmm.
I mean, they're taking it directly over, or, well, essentially using the Japanese labor to process lumber.
The value-added part.
They're taking over the value-added part. They're buying raw logs or...
Yeah.
Right, from us and processing them on shipboard
right.
as they're being delivered.
What?
Right. I hadn't heard of that, but...
2020 or one of those, and about the beef, too, they're becoming more affluent over there and thinking that it's probably good to eat beef or, you know, that on the other... And they're sending cowboys out to Montana to learn how to...
They're buying land out there, maybe?
Uh-huh, yeah. And they're buying land, and then they're sending these guys over, just like they send them into the companies, and teaching them how to be cowboys.
That's right, I saw that.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, they want to infiltrate every area that they can. I just was really amazed when I read...
K.O. economics graduates?
Yeah.
Fishing? Worldwide fishing industry has gone, Japan brings fish from all over the world, right? Including.
They're not necessarily ahead of us then.
Well, there seems to be one comparison I've heard is that Japanese boats will go out for 6 months to 2 years in a factory process, catch and freeze and ship back, where a lot of American fishing communities are still into 3, 4, 7 day trips at most, and then they're back on shore. So the Americans are not going as far or catching as much and are not as mechanized. Construction equipment, right? Heavy equipment in general. Bulldozers, Caterpillar and International Harvester have lost a great deal to Komatsu.
Computer chips?
Cars.
Cars,
yeah,
right?
Lots of Japanese.
Right? Computer chips. Computer chips is still quite a battleground, and there are enough different types of computer chips to where specialization has allowed each country to maintain advantages in specific areas. Cars is a good example, and I sort of thought that would be the first one to come up. But in most of these fields that we're picking up, there are more Japanese companies in the field surviving and competing than there ever were American companies. The cars is the best example. What are our big three in the U.S.? Ford, GM, and Chrysler traditionally. How many Japanese car manufacturers can you think of?
Ford, Mazda, Nissan,
well,
Isuzu.
Mazda, Nissan, Toyota,
Honda.
Isuzu,
Honda.
Well, just lost Mr. Honda, but Daihatsu, Suzuki,
Subaru,
Mitsubishi. Okay, there are nine. I think we just got them. But there are nine Japanese companies making cars. They all export and they all sell in the U.S.
Except isn't Subaru now is completely owned by Datsun.
Right. That's just a something that's happened this year. Subaru has been a real successful producer of cars, but they weren't staying financially healthy. But that's the first case in 40 years of one of these Japanese companies having had to combine with another one.
Thank you.
You can add to that Yamaha, which produces engines for Toyota and Ford, and could make a car anytime they wanted to, but they don't want to become the 10th Japanese car exporter.
Banking?
Right. Major banks, the 10 biggest, the 20 biggest, you'll find more Japanese banks in that list than you will from any other country. Okay, which points to something else, that there's a lot of internal competition here. We talk about cooperation. The amount of competition between 9 Japanese car companies, all looking at each other's products, has gotten to be more intense than 3 U.S. companies, or 9 or 10 or 15 or however many you count the money center banks in Japan, compared with, I don't know how many money center banks there are in New York, the big ones, Chase Manhattan, Citibank, manufacturers Hanover, 6, 7 maybe. But the competition and the profit margins have always been smaller on this side, and that has probably led to more competitive skills over there. So that what we're up against is not necessarily different management styles, but simply hotter competition that has moved overseas and has become able to compete around the world. Let me try one other aspect of looking at Japanese business here. Instead of making a horizontal division here, I'm going to make it.
Before you erase that, now Japan has had the stock market. They've had fraud, where they've had kickbacks on stock losses to the bigger companies. And that.
Right.
You know, that just goes, to me, that goes opposite of what they stand for, or what they have traditionally stood for then. The openness, concern of people, stability, everything else. And that, you know, it's undermining a culture that basically is part of their company and their political political process, political parties, and now with this fraud, so, you know, you could look at that, well, you know, they aren't 10 foot tall, they've got fraud there, just the same as they have every country around the world.
Right. Is everyone familiar with this situation? This news story where the Japanese stock market has gone through a tremendous boom cycle followed by a tremendous bust in and around the Gulf War time. Securities houses are supposed to trade stocks and bonds on behalf of their clients. When the client enters an order, the securities house executes the order and delivers the securities or keeps the account straight. What's happened was that several big security companies were compensating their big clients for losses. It says, go ahead and invest money with me, buy 1 million shares of Toyota stock. Normally, if you lose, that's supposed to be your problem. But the securities companies were trying to pump sales through. So for their biggest customers, they said, even if you lose money, we'll give you some back.
To the millions of dollars.
To the millions of dollars, right. To the millions of, billions of yen, millions of dollars. Which is the kind of thing which is not unknown in this country. In the 19th century, we had law after law passed to cut down on similar scandals of similar proportion. But it says that Japan has the same kind of problems that we have.
Two things that come to mind here as we look at these lists. We've kind of made the inference that you know, you've got good and you've got bad. There's been a lot of things said about the limitations of the actual workforce in Japan that works for these companies involved in all these, quote, good things that are up there. And I've heard figures in the neighborhood of 10-15%, and the remainder work for much, much less than guaranteed employment,
right,
et cetera, et cetera. Also, some of the, quote, long-standing relationships become a very dominant one by the parent company, whereby it's a long-standing relationship, but the supplier becomes dependent on the company,
right. Yeah.
Solely, and the companies use that very definitely to leverage their suppliers.
What we can do then is maybe take the U.S. side of the board for a minute, and let's look at the flip side of what is generally considered to be Japan's strengths. Right? Lifetime employment, for one, is a great place to start, because we're talking about the world leader in longevity right now. And Life expectancy is somewhere around 82, 83 for men, 88 for women. If you're hired right out of university, assuming you're one of the fortunate ones who gets through with a good university, good job offer, and go right into a company, maybe you're 21, 22 years old and you're going to work until you're 55. That's what's guaranteed. What is that, 33 years? After 55, assume you live to be 85, which is not unlikely, that's another 30 years. Now you haven't had anything like lifetime employment. You've worked maybe half of your productive life and certainly less than your total life for this one company. That poses a great problem for pension, for welfare, for Social Security in the older generations. As Nancy said, very rapidly they will be approaching a society where if nothing changes, there'll be four retirees for every one person working. Long-term relationships. In and around Nagoya, which is dominated by Toyota, you have, a similar system to what might exist in Seattle, so maybe it's not that, maybe not that strange from our point of view, where the Toyota employees are on this lifetime track, and so are some of the major subcontractors. But Toyota's able to say, we're introducing a new model of car. What is this, 1991? The production cycle, the planning would be about 2.5 years, maybe. In 1994, we're going to come up with a new, lightweight, low-cost car because we think that's where the market's going. Each of you are building bearings. We'll bring in our big bearing customers. And we've been buying bearings from all of you. We've supported you for decades. The new car is going to be lighter. It's going to have to go faster. It's going to need better precision bearings than had ever been made in the automotive industry. They're going to have to be 65% of the size of the ones we're using now. So they'll be much smaller. And by the way, because they're smaller, we're going to pay you only 65% of what we've been paying you already. The first one of you who comes back with success in producing, being able to produce not one bearing, but be able to produce it on a production line basis with Japanese state-of-the-art quality control, and you all know what that means, maybe one defect out of a million, and we'll call you in to explain that defect when it happens. The first one of you that's able to do that will get the contract. Goodbye, good luck. And so you will have to, at that point, keep your engineers up all night for weeks figuring out how to do this, how to downsize the bearing, how to get better, lower friction, longer life, better testing procedures than you've ever used before, better instruments than you've ever used before, and so on. And Toyota is able to knock heads very strongly. On this. And supposing you are the one that comes up with the best bearing and the answer, then by the time that millionth bearing shows up with a defect, we'll call you in on the carpet, explain what the defect was, how we found it, and you'll have a week to come back and tell us how you've changed your processes so it'll never happen again. It's very severe
and then
management
from
above.
Would they share that technology with the other companies that had been in the competition?
No, the other companies will find ways to get a hold of one of those bearings and take it apart and see what they've done to it.
But the parent company wouldn't give that technology, share it with the others?
Not in specific terms. There can be general, there's a lot of general terms. But no, the suppliers can be very bitter rivals here. As we've seen, I worked 3 years with a Japanese bearing engineer who came over to help a Georgia company improve their steel ball quality, the ball for the ball bearing. After 3 years, the Georgia company was not able to improve to world standards. In fact, they hardly improved at all. They were bought out by a Japanese company that was the rival of the place where my engineer had spent his whole life. And his attitude was, rather than, wow, here's a chance to work for a Japanese company, it was, I'm going home. If I wanted to work for these guys, I could have done it in Japan. Spent my whole life competing with them. I don't want to have anything to do with them. So he's back in Japan, and the rival company is now running the plant in Georgia. The competition is really severe and in many cases bitter. So we should point that out about long-standing relationships, that they can be dominated by what you call the parent company. And for one of your companies to change and start supplying Mazda or Nissan with bearings represents a radical change of policy. You probably won't be allowed to ever sell a bearing to Toyota again. Unless you're one of the lucky ones and you can come up with a technology that is so great that suddenly everybody has to have it. Then you'll have 9 car companies pounding on your door to get the secret to the better bearing or the better mousetrap which you've built. And occasionally that happens.
Isn't another drawback of this longstanding relationship the corruption that sometimes evolves, or is that something?
Yeah, I think there's a real relation.
Corruption's an interesting word. You know that gift-giving is a longstanding Oriental practice, right? When gift-giving between contractors of longstanding relationships obviously takes place all the time. Now, what's the difference between a gift and a bribe? Is there one?
Well, it's a gift. Is it that you expect a gift in return?
Expect a gift in return or a contract in return. But the reason I'm giving you a gift is because we've had contracts for so many years to our mutual advantage. And I probably send you, well, at least we'll exchange calendars, company calendars, and paperweights, and probably quite a bit of entertainment expense in the local restaurant community. And we may exchange engineers on contracts now and then to have one work in the other's plant and learn what's being involved. That can be a type of bribery.
But I'm saying, like,
to make, simply making your knowledge available to someone else.
Stock investment companies will try, they want to keep this big customer,
right?
Even to the expense of losing smaller customers. So they're going to somehow, even giving kickbacks or whatever, by whatever means, they're going to try to maintain that relationship.
One Boeing as a customer is worth all the Holden Villages and Pacific Lutheran Universities and all those people who might now and then invest a nickel or a dime with you. It's almost a different phenomenon. We're getting way off track if we start discussing why scandals are brought to light in Japan in the way in which they are. A lot of things like this people have known they've been going on for a long time. Why did they suddenly hit the fan at this time? Two or three prime ministers in previous years were embarrassed out of office through kickbacks or relations with mistresses and so on. And yet I don't think any particular Japanese citizen was surprised that politicians occasionally gave and received money or had relationships with women to whom they were not married. That would hardly surprise anyone. And yet at some point it was determined in the press that the scandal had reached a critical mass and this was the opportunity to break it, and it would not be detrimental to the national interest to do so. Right?
So is that a relative free press then?
It's a national press to a greater extent maybe even than ours is. Four major newspapers are read from one end of the country to the other. Now they compete with each other for news, and the networks compete with each other for news, but their reporters all go to the same briefings and all belong to the same press club. And it's very seldom that a story will be broken in one and not in all of the others. A good example would be several years ago when one of the imperial tombs in Osaka was excavated, and some of the artifacts that were found, the tombs are hardly ever touched. They're considered sacred, they belong to the imperial family. Some old mirrors and bronze artifacts were brought to light, and the comment was that they were very similar to Korean artifacts of the same era. This was in the front page of the Asahi Shimbun, one of the major newspapers. However, it then dawned on somebody that this was tantamount to saying the imperial family was descended from Koreans. And the story never appeared in the newspaper again, ever. Still not to this day. Now, it's not obviously not politically acceptable to stand up and say that the imperial family are Korean. Nor am I saying that. But that was the, in case anyone wants to go back and write an article on the Asahi Shimbun. But there's a consensus on what is acceptable to say and what's not acceptable to say. And the stockbroking scandal came out at a time when it was acceptable to say such a thing because there was a lot of private people, a lot of small people had lost substantial amounts of money in the market, and there was considerable public anger against the way the people with the big money were manipulating prices and manipulating land values. And so the fact that this appeared in the paper can be interpreted, I think, as speaking on behalf of the public consciousness. Okay. Some of these other things, office layout is open. What does that do to productivity? Anybody ever worked in a room with 180 other people at the same time? High school study halls, remember them? Okay, this may in itself be related to long hours, right? The office floor is the man's living space. That's your apartment, that's your country club, that's your socializing area. As long as you're sitting at your desk with maybe one or two pieces of paper, a newspaper, a spreadsheet, a report out there, you can be drinking tea or talking to someone, and it's presumed that you're talking business, and most of the time you will be talking something related to business. But the head down, actual working type pose isn't demanded of someone, as long as you're at your place. So that becomes, during the 80-90% of your waking time when you're not home, that becomes your living space. And the drive to achieve, to get your work done so that you can go home at 5 o'clock isn't normally there to the extent that we see it.
Well, you know, I had a friend of John's who's in the banking industry at the Target headquarters. I don't know if you all know, or in a part of the country where Target is, but it's a big discount chain in the western half of the country. And their corporate headquarters are in Minneapolis. And another friend of the boys was part of that. And so he took this Japanese young man through there. And his comment on all the little booths, you know, there are these little temporary walls that are set up around everybody's workstation in our corporate headquarters or offices. His comment was, how does anyone ever manage when they can't see who they're managing?
Right.
That's really interesting.
If you're managing in Japan, you can see who you're managing and what they're doing.
He just couldn't believe this. They have little walls around every desk.
That comment is almost always made by Japanese who are visiting American offices. It's one you hear real frequently. The American comment going to Japan is, how can you get anything done in this bullpen, right?
Yeah. But also, it would give better communication, wouldn't it? An open sort of a place like that. You'd always be communicating with people you're working with.
That's the problem.
Yeah. Well, it's a problem. It's a problem and an advantage. If you're in an American office and you want to communicate with somebody, where do you communicate? Telephone, call them up.
Fax.
Voicemail. Yeah, meet at the water cooler. Voicemail. Right? Voicemail. Yeah, you never see them. You play telephone tag. Coffee breaks, maybe. But they have to be at designated times, so the manager doesn't see you in the canteen with a cup of coffee at the wrong time. Right? Or maybe you go to their office. But it takes a special effort to do that. And that in itself can be, by Japanese standards, construed as a little inefficient. You have to talk to your fellow workers. How can you live without doing that? You've got to keep the group ties together.
There's some people like, there's open classroom ideas I know in Salt Lake, and that means a whole bunch of kids going, and there's classes going on all the time. One big room, teachers teaching different things, and the kids growing up with that really like that. Mm-hmm. And yet there's a certain amount of discipline that you stay in your area on a table.
Yeah.
And you work at it. It's not like, you know, you're in charge in a room and then it's passed to another room.
Somehow I have trouble equating that with the Japanese office. I imagine shelves full of Legos all around the room.
No, it's not Legos, but they're running English classes, math classes, everything. Yeah. Goes in one big room,
right.
And you might have three different classes running.
Hmm.
At the same time. Haven't you ever heard of that?
Yeah, yeah, right.
I mean, but to me, it's what you get used to. Hmm. I mean, if they're used to being with all these people, I think that whether they're there or not, you know, it's not like study hall.
Then we take graduates of those systems and put them in cubicles. From the Japanese system, though, you've grown up through school with 40 students in one room facing the teacher working on one problem. Mm-hmm. Therefore, when you take those 40 people and put them in a bigger room of 160, it's not that different. You're all in desks facing the section head, and you're all working on a related problem.
Yeah.
So focusing is probably not that big an issue. Incidentally, the desks almost always face away from the window. Yeah.
Are Japanese people not privacy conscious?
Very.
Well, I think very privacy conscious, but there's not the opportunity for much of it.
You know, they seem to be constantly with people. So. You know, at home it's tight, the living space in the office here in this big home. So are they able to sort of be private within a big home?
Yeah, space consciousness is a real important part of that. You and I could be sitting in a large American living room this far apart and having a perfectly good conversation. Here we're maybe 10 feet, 12 feet apart. in Japan, if I wanted to really be talking to you, I would come and sit right here, you know, like this. And this is the distance over which you have a personal conversation. Now, Nancy's far too far away. She may be in the same room. In fact, she can probably hear what we're saying. But the Japanese social contract is such that she's not part of it. And unless she's inclined to eavesdrop, she will, which is rude, but she will be going about her own business and probably able to, able to wall out whatever we're talking about, unless we're talking about what she's wearing or, you know, something that has to do with her, like anybody in your ears pick up.
You know, here the theory is when somebody comes very close to you, they're invading your space.
Invading your space, yeah. Right. Yeah. And Japanese in any kind of group activity will learn, especially if there's a desk there, uh-huh. from here up, from the middle of the torso up, to be looking like they're attentive at all times. Uh-huh. That attentiveness means leaning forward. Uh-huh. And to lean forward with somebody is to reduce the distance between you and to help communication. In the U.S., if we're talking over a desk, which is probably bigger in the first place, and I lean forward, I'm what? I'm threatening. Yeah. You can be threatening. That's a threatening position. To put somebody at ease, we lean back.
Yeah.
Right? From the butt to the spine makes a diagonal line here, and the rest of this chair is irrelevant. So Japanese who are sitting at conferences, if they're tense, will put that tension into their shoes, curl their toes, do anything that's invisible. Always have at least one hand maybe around or like this. If they're falling asleep, you can do anything you want with your feet, but learn to sit like this, uh-huh. right? Whether it's at faculty meetings or you know, whatever. You can't even take your shoes off and work at the table in your socks, but just remember to put those shoes on before you get up and go to the tea machine, because walking around the office in your socks is a breach of etiquette. Anything that goes on below table level is that sort of informal private space.
So your life is
there. I didn't come here to talk about this, but this is just... Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, it seems like the Americans prefer to be kind of fenced in anyway, because like in our homes, you know, we're happy with a fence. If we don't have one, we're going to put one up.
Yeah.
You know, we seem to be more happy. And then inside our homes, like, you know, your room and my room, it's mm-hmm. not like your space and, you know, in the one big room.
We grew up with...
room with walls, yeah. my room with walls, you know, we seem to be more happy fenced in.
We want a room of our own.
Yeah, our own space.
We do put fences around our yards. Maybe, ironically, maybe it's the Japanese concept of privacy and the compactness of the city, but garden walls in Japan are typically concrete block higher than your head, 6-7 feet high. Gray. And all that gray limestone has come out of the Japanese steel mills since 1950, I'm sure, as a byproduct of the steel process. But those are real visual barriers. So walking down the street, you walk between gray concrete block walls. Here, we have yards that are attractive to look at from the outside. They complement the house to the passerby, right? The Japanese garden is part of the inside space, and it's made to be looked at from the house as a to benefit the person in the house who's looking out. So the garden wall is a little bit kind of an opposite example, but the wanting a room of your own and that sort of thing is definitely, I think, yeah, it's the same thing we're talking about. Right, where was I? Let me move on to another subject, if I can, quickly, since we're about at 11:30 here. And that is something we don't usually think about when we think about relations between companies or business culture relations, and that's who we are, each of us, what time in history we grew up, what events formed our consciousness and our approach toward each other. Let me just put a timeline here. And I'll start at 1940. Let's go 50, 60, 70, 80, and 90. And here we are at the end of it at 91. And let's put Japan on one side, the US on the other. Actually, I could go back before this, back to 30s. In the 30s in the US, we had, first thing, depression, right? Depression, Roosevelt, alphabet soup, government spending as a way to pull the economy out of depression. We were fairly isolated in terms of, we weren't terribly internationally conscious at that point. I think we kind of wrapped up in our own economic problems. In Japan,
They were conquering the world.
Well, yeah. Militant nationalism. Not necessarily economically, there was some of that, but militarily, right? The Japanese were sweeping through Asia. And we get in the 1940s here, and a little bit earlier in Japan, war, okay? So someone who is 60 to 65 years old now, these are the chairman, the CEOs, the department managers, the senior members of not only American and Japanese businesses, but universities and all other institutions. Let's look at that generation. Say you came out of your schooling and your developmental years through World War II. A Japanese I know was a chemistry major, graduated with a chemistry degree in 1945. Heck of a time to be finding a job in Japan. There wasn't one operating chemical plant in the country. He did what anyone else with talent and drive did. He ran black market goods for a couple of years to survive, and then went into education. Okay, so someone who comes out of this experience comes out of defeat for Japan, for the U.S., victory, and the national understanding of what World War II meant to both countries is obviously radically different, what it meant to our own experience. Let's look in the around 50s. We had the occupation of Japan. The U.S. economy here, world dominance, about one half of the world GNP, 1945 to 50, came out of the United States of America. A phenomenal advantage. Virtually unlikely to happen again, it would seem, I would hope. Politically, where do we go in the 50s? What was going on here?
Eisenhower,
right? Cold War. Okay.
Korea.
Sputnik. The Sputnik shock in education, about how we had to drive our kids to learn more math and science to keep up with the Russians. Over in Japan, they weren't worried about putting up satellites. It was basic rebuilding, steel, shipbuilding, basic chemical industries, soda, ash, very unremarkable products from the standpoint of what the world was doing, but beginning with a very basic type of industry. And here we start getting the technocracy that came out of the Cold War, late Eisenhower era. When we get into the 60s in Japan, we have what's called the economic miracle. Really starting to take off. Late 60s and 70s in America, Vietnam,
right?
The whole 60s phenomenon, mistrust authority. What's going on up here? The Japanese economy was not affected as profoundly by Vietnam, except in a critical sense. It started fragmenting the student movement, and some people started being quite distrustful, not in a mainstream way, but of the uses of power in the world. The economic miracle went on into global penetration, Japanese business spreading around the world, putting businesses, manufacturers out of work in other countries. And we go into the Iran hostage situation down here, Reagan, yuppies, new affluence, the new emergence of the new young Republicans, where Japan is going on into an aging society here, and what would be called a baby trough, I guess, rather than a baby boom in school, where our grown-up baby boomers are becoming the yuppies. Okay, so what kind of people are dealing with each other on both sides of the Pacific? If you have people at the 60 to 65-year-old level, you have Japanese who've seen, have been able to stand in their younger years at one end of Tokyo and literally see all the way across it to the hills on the other side, not a building standing for miles, except the Imperial Palace, and have seen the basic rebuilding coming up. These are the folks who've had probably the most drive and dedication toward pushing the economy through this basic rebuilding and economic miracle, the desire to rebuild from nothing. Here we've had World War II generation people who, to a certain extent, have felt that World War II established, I'm not speaking for everybody, but for individuals, established the right of democracy. It was a victory for against the powers of fascist depression and so on, and that something was established here, which, whatever else you say about it, there was nowhere near as much drive to succeed and build. In fact, there was probably a drive to get the profit that you can from the advantages we had after the war. Let's go down about 10 years. The generation that graduated from their schooling, received their formative experiences in this time in Japan, is called the Lost Generation, all right, in Japan. These are men who, as soon as they graduated, were snapped up in the basic rebuilding, spent 12 to 15 hours a day at their desks their entire lives, never learned how to spend a day off, never learned how to enjoy travel, freedom, never were conspicuous spenders of any sort. But people who are just sort of gray by their own admission, nondescript, and these are the people who are the vice presidents and sort of the supporting generation and emerging now into positions of leadership in Japan. They're talking about increasing consumer spending in Japan, increasing enjoyment and so on, but the leaders are people who have generally never experienced that themselves. Over here, enjoyment of leisure, you bet. Right? There was no one had to work two jobs in order to afford a house, or very few people did. There were still people coming up, social mobility-wise, but the average American house was well within the ability of the average American to afford all through this time. So we have a group of people who have not had much experience of leisure or affluence, and a group of people who have had quite a bit, facing each other across the table. Let's go out one more generation here. We're dealing with Japanese who have grown up at the height of the economic miracle and have seen Japan able to do anything in terms of targeting a product, targeting an industry, being able to produce it, sell it, achieve, and win. And the ability of Japan to do that is almost taken for granted there. These are very comfortable people, very comfortable and confident in their own ability to be able to stake out new ground and cover it. On the other side, the Vietnam generation, comfortable, confident, no, disillusioned, right, very mistrustful of authority, very much less likely to stand up and volunteer for a national goal or for a targeting of an objective, of a product, of an export market that would be in any way injurious to someone else's livelihood, right? Another very different group of people facing each other across the negotiating table, because this is my generation. I probably know more Japanese at this level better than I know people in any other area, but we've worked together. And it always comes as a shock to them when I work through some of the mistrust or disillusionment that I've felt from the Vietnam years. This is alien, it's foreign, it's fascinating, it's intriguing to them that anyone could really have been shaken profoundly by what happened, by the King and Bobby Kennedy assassinations, for example. So there are at least three very different generations of people here who are facing each other across the table as our industries go about addressing our economic and social issues. This isn't something that's often discussed, but I think it's a good thing to understand when we see visitors from Japan. Now, in the later areas, I think we're probably coming closer together. And the destinies, in fact, of U.S. and Japanese businesses and societies, I think, are linked very, very closely. We seem to be going in the same direction, whether we like it or not, whether we like each other or not. Any questions or comments at this point? We're nearing the end of the hour, so I'd like to throw it back to you. There are several things that we were talking about covering that we haven't covered that I haven't been able to do very much with. And so I'd like to spend the last few minutes in as focused a way as I can.
Would you say that the gap between the rich and the poor is increasing?
In Japan?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, certainly, dramatically. That's a good point to bring up. Is the gap between the rich and the poor increasing in this country? I think we assume that it is. But in Japan, the the gap between those who own homes now and those who don't and probably never will is becoming an issue of very important concern. If you live in one of the main cities, and Japan's a city-centered society, it's increasingly necessary to live 2 hours out by train, one way, in order to afford home properties. And not many of us would think of driving 2 hours one way to work.
I think that if they're becoming, and you were saying this yesterday, more consumers, and we're trying to encourage them to be more of a consuming nation, that they would get where we were. I think, like with U.S. Steel being one of the companies, you know, that went by the wayside, some of that was caused by us being so greedy as wanting those shorter work hours, larger pay, and time off. I mean, you're talking 3 months off vacation type stuff for leisure.
Two houses, a boat, and Winnebago.
And that kind of thing, but you wanted the money, so you get, you know, $25 an hour as laborer, more than the professional people were making, so you could get these things to buy. Well, now those laborers over there haven't been anywhere near that kind of income. But when they get there, then they have something to buy. I think they'd be more, I don't know if they have unions in Japan, is what I'm saying.
No, they do.
There might be some union people in there that would bang me over the head, but I see that as being a problem, that quick rise with the income level of our laborers.
It's hard to deny
that. They have a hat, because laborers seem to be happy with just kind of managing along.
No, I think laborers over there want things as much as laborers over here do, in a way. It's a question of what's available, what can I get? I can't live half an hour from a lake if I'm in Tokyo.
But it's their wage there, that they can afford that when they're, I mean, laborers could afford it. Our laborers had a lot of stuff.
In terms of purchasing power?
Yeah.
Over these years of growth from 50s, 60s, 70s, yeah, our laborers have had more money and more purchasing power in their hands than the Japanese have had until quite recently. And the exchange rate has skewed that, too, to where labor in Japan is no longer cheap. It's very expensive.
You might talk about the unions. Yeah.
The unions in Japan exist. They do want shorter hours for workers. They do want better working conditions. They resist any hint of layoffs. But unions are confined basically within their own companies. So that a member of a union in Mitsubishi Automobile doesn't necessarily equate to the same member in Toyota. He can't take his skill from Mitsubishi and go to work for Toyota. Then a union leadership in Mitsubishi Auto will be trying to get the best conditions it can for its own workers, but the leaders of the union generally are the next managers.
In that company.
Oh,
so it's just better communications between employers and the employee themselves.
There are a lot of ironies in that relationship.
You could call it co-optation, or you could call
it co-optation. Right. Union leaders in this country have been hired in the management too, and have generally been roundly cussed out by the rank and file members when they do that. It's looked at as a betrayal. Mm-hmm. There it happens much more frequently. The same opinions are heard, but they don't affect the system. And a pipe fitter from one refinery with a union membership is not welcomed as a pipe fitter in another refinery if you want to change employers. It's not the kind of thing that you can carry laterally with you.
One thing I was wondering how this is going to play out. They've had a savings rate of about three times ours, 15% or 5% roughly or something like that. Now, if they increase spending or consumer spending, is that going to affect, you know, their capital available, capital to buy and to expand and to world markets, or is this saving rate only at a higher end, or are these people saving all the way up and on the economic ladder at that 15% rate? Do you know anything about that?
I am fairly certain it's not all the way up and down the economic ladder. People at the bottom of the economic ladder generally have very little to spend, and that's probably true in Japan too, especially when they're trying to afford housing.
Yeah. Okay with the housing.
However, the amounts of savings we're talking about are so huge, when we're talking about three times the American rate of savings, that any significant change in consumer spending is only going to affect a little bit of that. You could take another day off, and I suppose work 4 days and mm-hmm. spend another day shopping, and it would make another big effect in consumer spending. It plays itself out in different ways. I think there are a lot of forces involved in the amount of money and capital that's available in Japan. Sheer productivity is one of it, one part of it. When you produce more items of value, you're going to have more money and more capital assets to play with and to invest where you want. We, for so many years here, have looked at not trying, not focusing on the production of an item of value. What does it mean to create value, you know, out of raw materials, to add value? Our business managers and our MBAs, and I happen to have been through MBAs,